I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, A Secret History of the Stars, with Jo Marchan and her new book, The Human Cosmos. Jo Marchan is an award-winning science journalist. She has a PhD in genetics and medical microbiology from St Bartholomew's Hospital Medical College and an MSc in science communication from Imperial College. She's worked as an editor at New Scientist in Nature, and her articles have appeared in The Guardian, Wired, Observer, New York Times and The Washington Post. And she's the author of Decoding the Heavens, shortlisted for the Royal Society Prize for Science Books, and Cure, which was shortlisted for the Royal Society Prize for Science Books and longlisted for the Wellcome Book Prize. And Jo's latest book, which we're going to talk about today, The Human Cosmos, A Secret History of the Stars. Jo, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us, first of all, what the idea is behind The Human Cosmos.
It's really a story of the universe, of the cosmos, if you like, but not the sort of normal story that astronomers might tell, starting with the Big Bang and going through the sort of evolution of galaxies in our solar system. It's more to do with the cosmos as we see it. So starting with the very first people who looked to the sky and how they made sense of the stars, and following that through the sort of history of humanity. So I was interested in what the influence of the sky has been. So different views of the cosmos, how that's shaped different aspects of human society and civilization. But also now, you know, we've never been more cut off, more isolated from the sky, you know, with light pollution. We can't see the stars in the way that we used to be able to do. And with modern technologies that we have, like watches and sat navs and air conditioning, electric lights, you know, we live in a way that's very much separated from the cycles of the solar system and the cosmos. So I was interested in whether that matters. You know, are we losing anything? So what have the stars kind of given us through history, and what does it mean if we're no longer really paying attention to them?
Yeah, and you do sort of pose the question at the beginning of the book. Now science, for want of a better word, has sort of supplanted a lot of the ideas that you cover in this book. What is the point of looking at the way that, you know, the ancients used to look at some of these ideas? And so, you know, why do you think, or what do you think is the point? But also, I guess, as well as the ideas of like light pollution hiding us from the sort of greater cosmos, we have these amazing images of the cosmos. We've been out into space, we've explored it. But why do you think we've lost touch with some of those ideas as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a massive fan of science. My background's in science. I've written a lot about science. I love science, and we do have this incredible scientific understanding of the universe. Now we understand more about the physical cosmos than, you know, we ever did before. We've got this sort of unprecedented view into black holes and neutron stars and galaxies and, you know, going back to the Big Bang, and I that's fantastic. But I was interested in what has that supplanted in a way. So we have this kind of mathematical sort of physical understanding. I was very struck by the idea that the study of the cosmos used to be about, you know, the meaning of life, if you like, the meaning of existence, the nature of reality, what are we doing in this universe? And now we think of cosmology as mathematical astronomy, basically. It's a much, much narrower field. So what happened to all of those questions that people had? And I think with the rise of science, it's been so persuasive and so powerful. You know, it can do so much. You know, this idea of just taking what's measurable, looking for an objective sort of third person understanding of physical matter and reality. And it's been brilliant at helping us to understand and manipulate physical matter, that we've kind of almost downgraded everything else. So the idea of having a first person subjective experience of the cosmos, if you like, just looking to the stars and how does that make us feel? What does that tell us about life, about the world? That's what's been lost. And that was what I was interested in investigating, if you like, and trying to work out what role has that played through the history of humanity, and what, you know, do we need that now? Is that important?
You first look at the discovery in the modern day, relatively modern day, of the Paleolithic cave paintings at Lascaux in France, and you know, other places subsequently. I've been to the reconstruction of the cave at Altamira in the north of Spain, and as you talk about in the book here, one of the things you immediately notice is that these are all depictions of animals. Like, apart from the odd handprint, you don't really see depictions of people in these cave paintings. So let's talk about perhaps why.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult when you're talking about paintings from the Paleolithic. I mean, obviously there were no written records, so we have to be really careful. Yeah, there are so many different theories about what these paintings mean. And the starting point that I have was I read in an astronomy textbook that there is this idea that there's this painting of a bull, this huge painting of a bull in Lascaux Cave, with a cluster of dots above its shoulder, and the theory that this might represent the constellation Taurus, which has its eye, the star Aldebaran, and it has the Pleiades cluster of stars just above its shoulder. And I was just really intrigued by this, and I wanted to know, is this true? You know, could they really have been painting star maps back in the Paleolithic? So I wanted to try and investigate that. And so we can't say anything definite about whether it definitely was, but it's certainly a very close match with the constellation of Taurus. And there is even some work looking at how the sky would have looked back then, showing that actually the stars would have been an even closer match back at the time that these paintings were made. And also there's other work that people can do to try and get us a little bit closer to how the people of the Paleolithic might have been thinking about their world. So the kind of traditional idea about them is that they are painting the animals that are important to them, the kind of cycles that they would have seen on Earth, the different animals that mattered to them in their lives. But there's also an idea that they were painting a sort of more holistic view of their cosmos in general. So one theory that was presented is that the different animals are painted at different times of year. So when you have different animals painted together, you always have the horses painted first, and the oryx, and then the stags on top, and they're painted, and each species is shown at its mating season. So this idea that you've got this sort of cycle of the seasons and the mating of the animals, and that's all being shown together, and it's very much the paintings of people who sort of saw themselves as part of nature, if you like. They didn't really make a big separation between themselves and the animals that they saw around them. But there's lots of sort of circumstantial evidence, if you like, suggesting that they were very interested in the sky as well. You know, the stars, the different constellations that would have been rising and setting was changing with the seasons. There are anthropologists looking at more recent hunter-gatherer peoples who had lives similar in complexity to how we think the people would have lived in the Paleolithic, and they invariably have very sophisticated cosmologies. They're very interested in the different constellations that are rising and setting in the sky, very interested in the solstices, and this is all bound up in different mythologies. So, you know, the changes they saw in the sky were wrapped up in the changes that they saw on the earth. They wouldn't have seen a big separation between the two. There's one more line of work looking at myths and tracing different versions of myths that are found all around the planet. There's one called the Cosmic Hunt, where an animal is hunted and ends up going up into the sky and being transformed into a constellation. And you can find different versions of this myth among traditional people all around the world. And there was a really interesting study that was done to try and make a family tree of these myths using similar techniques to how DNA sequences are studied, and concluding that the original version of that myth actually arose in Eurasia in Paleolithic times. So that is again supporting the idea that people at that time were interested in the sky, and that elements of those myths can actually survive from then and still be told now. So if you put all of those things together, it does build a picture of people who not only didn't separate themselves from nature, but really didn't separate the earth from the sky. All of these changes were entwined and happening together.
And so then you go on to look at the beginnings of the Neolithic and the sort of time when human beings were first starting to adopt some form of agriculture. You talk about a site in modern-day Turkey called Göbekli Tepe, which is right bang in the centre of this area where agriculture starts. And again, for these first couple of chapters that we're talking about, we're going to change that in a moment, but the first couple of chapters, we really are talking about deduction, speculation as to... because there's no sort of like, you know, direct written evidence as to what these sites were used for. But this site and another site that's nearby in Turkey that are sort of like buildings but like cave-like structures you talk about. Again, what do we think these might have been for?
Yeah, Göbekli Tepe is really interesting because it's 12,000 years old. It appears, so it's way before Stonehenge. It's just before the origins of farming, which happened in exactly this region. And you've got these great sort of circles with like stone benches around the edge of these circles that are dug down into the ground. And then in the center of the circles and around the edges as well, actually, there are these great pillars, these kind of flat stone pillars, sort of T-shaped, like flat T-shaped, up to sort of 5.5 meters high, and decorated with loincloths and necklaces. There are lots of carvings of animals all around the place as well. And so one thing that's interesting about this is that it was always assumed that the sort of Neolithic revolution when humans first started to farm was this kind of key transition that happened, and that perhaps in response to sort of climate change and sort of pressure on resources, people needed to start farming to produce enough food. And it was that that enabled larger settlements, more sophisticated societies, and then people could start building these megalithic monuments, stone circles, that sort of thing. But what's interesting about Göbekli Tepe is that this came first. You've got these huge stone monuments that would have required really sort of complex society and a lot of people working together to make them, but it was actually just before people started farming. So the argument is being made by the archaeologists working on it and other scholars as well, that there was some kind of change in mindset that caused people to make these sites. And that change in mindset, which had to do with people elevating themselves above nature, was what then enabled people to contemplate farming, if you see what I mean. And so then you can ask, well, what were these sites all about? And again, it's really difficult to say, but you've got these circular enclosures that were dug down into the ground. You've got these T-shapes that seem to be some kind of anthropomorphic being. The archaeologists think they're some kind of transcendent being. They're not naturalistic. They don't seem to be sort of mortal humans. And you would have climbed into these circular enclosures through little porthole stones that often had like dead animals carved around the edge. So they think that they actually represented sort of portals to the underworld, sort of the realm of the dead, if you like. There are skulls everywhere as well, markings on the skulls where it seems that these skulls were possibly hung up for display. So what it seems to be is there's a kind of change in mindset where in Lascaux you've only got animals being painted. Now it's very much sort of these humans, possibly ancestors, that are kind of center stage. The animals have kind of been demoted. They're much carved much smaller. And whereas the caves, there's a theory that these were seen as kind of portals to the underworld. Now people are building their own portals to the underworld. They're shaping the environment. They're shaping their sort of cosmos, if you like, to suit their own ideas. And it was that kind of change in mindset that then kind of allowed the transition to agriculture and to farming, which has then obviously led to all sorts of technological developments that have, you know, allowed us to be where we are today.
And although it's, of course, literally a few thousand years later in construction, you mentioned Stonehenge, and thinking now is that Stonehenge may have played a similar role in this sort of idea between Stonehenge and a nearby site that would have been a site that represented the living and a site that represented the dead.
Yeah, it's interesting. So it took several thousand years then for the techniques of farming to spread from the Middle East to Europe and then to Ireland in the 4th millennium BC. And then you've got these stone tombs like Newgrange tomb, for example, and archaeologists working completely separately have got very similar theories about what those tombs represented and being, again, these sort of portals to the underworld, these sort of circular tombs with these alcoves inside, and perhaps and Newgrange, of course, is aligned to the winter solstice, so the sun shines straight in on the winter solstice and lights up the heart of the tomb. But as the society became more complex, these tombs are getting bigger and bigger, and you've got more going on around the outside of the tomb. You're getting more complex kind of ceremonies, perhaps for sort of larger audiences. And so the idea is that those tombs could only go so far because you couldn't fit people inside to really see what was going on with the beam of sunlight coming in. And so the stone circles were perhaps a way of opening that up, so you can have these sort of big mass audiences seeing these effects, where Stonehenge, for example, is aligned to the summer solstice sunrise, and possibly more important was the winter solstice sunset. And so it's a kind of place for the ancestors, where the beam of sunlight is kind of at the winter solstice is giving you this kind of message about the cycle of life.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Jo Marchant, and we're talking about her latest book, The Human Cosmos. And Jo, you next go on to talk about the discovery, again, the latter-day discovery of the sort of Assyrian sites of like Nineveh and Babylon, and the discovery there of an ancient invention, which means we no longer have to speculate about what these people might have thought, what their mindsets were like. No more Stonehenge was a landing site for ancient aliens or something, you know. Now we know what they thought.
Yes, now we have writing, which makes a big difference. So in the next chapter, I'm looking at the discovery in particular of the library, this sort of collection of clay tablets of King Ashurbanipal, who was an Assyrian king. But he was obsessed with collecting texts from all over his empire, especially Babylonian texts. So this is, and this library was discovered in the 19th century. And so this is kind of the best and earliest kind of systematic insight we have into the sort of life and obsessions of an ancient civilization. We've got all of these texts here. And it turns out that what they were obsessed with was the sky. These are astrological omens. So the priests were watching the sky every night, looking at the sort of wanderings of the planets and particularly eclipses of the moon. And all of these different astronomical events had different meanings, different things that were likely to happen. If there was an eclipse of the moon, that was very bad news for the king, for example. So he had to have his team of astronomers kind of watching for what was happening. And so that's interesting in itself, that you can see still that that the celestial was bound up with the terrestrial. What happened in the sky was reflected on Earth. But also what's interesting about the Babylonians, and as we follow them then through the centuries, is that because they were so interested in what was happening in the sky, they were very good at mathematics. And so they started to identify repeating cycles, repeating patterns in the sky. And they were putting numbers to those, developing arithmetic theories that they could then use to predict what was going to happen next. They didn't have to watch for an eclipse. They could work it out. They knew when the next one was going to be. And we often think of the beginnings of scientific astronomy as being with the ancient Greeks, but actually it was the Babylonians who came up with the maths initially. The Greeks were much more about sort of the geometric side of how the universe might be arranged. They thought it was all these sort of celestial spheres and the planets kind of moving in these perfect circles. But they weren't actually putting any specific numbers to that until they came into contact with the Babylonians. And it was really those two traditions coming together that formed the foundations of what we might think of today as astronomy and astrology, for that matter. The Babylonians also came up with the idea of horoscopes. But this was the time when we really started to look at the sky and describe it in terms of numbers, of mathematics, of understanding and predicting what was going to happen next.
Yeah, I was going to say that, and when you were just first describing the Babylonian world, you mentioned both astrology and astronomy. But of course, really, at this time and for a while, it's the same thing, isn't it? These are both the same idea.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can use either word. So we don't really have a word, I suppose, that brings those two together. But yeah, for them, there would have been no sense in separating the two. And there really wasn't, you know, for many centuries later until the scientific revolution, I guess.
And so just a little bit later and to Rome, and you start the next chapter off with this depiction of this battle that sees Constantine basically come to power in Rome, and after his conversion, therefore the widespread adoption of Christianity. So I want to talk about, I guess, first of all, what a changing mindset to our sort of idea of the cosmos the adoption of monotheism brings. But then also, of course, we think of this being the time of the adoption of widespread Christianity after, you know, many centuries of them being persecuted by, you know, we think of them being persecuted by pagan Rome. But actually, you know, those what we think of as pagan beliefs, particularly beliefs in the sun, remain extremely important at this time.
Yeah, so what's interesting about Constantine is he is sort of credited with being the emperor who really sort of cemented Christianity. He was the one that supported it, made it the sort of official religion of the Roman Empire. And without him, Christianity wouldn't be the force that it is today. It was quite a minor religion at the time. So, but what's interesting is when you look at his beliefs is that it was all mixed up with beliefs about the sun. He also identified himself with the sun. He also worshipped the sun, and he helped to embed a lot of beliefs about the sun into Christianity. So he was the one that sort of decreed that Sunday would be the day of rest, for example. Of course, you've also got Christmas happening on the winter solstice, and you've got Easter as well, which is also defined around the spring equinox. So when the days are just starting to become longer than the nights, when they're just sort of, yeah, winning over the nights, if you like, then that's Easter, when sort of Christ is thought to have arisen. So you've got all of these kind of pagan sun worship elements within Christianity. So it wasn't quite the kind of abandoning the sun and introducing monotheism. It wasn't quite as clear cut as all that. But what is really interesting about that shift is it, for me, it really marked the moment when humanity changed from worshipping the sky itself, you know, worshipping the sky, worshipping the sun, worshipping the planets, which was pretty much a universal amongst all societies up until that point. And so monotheism with Judaism, Christianity, Islam is different because you've got this kind of abstract creator, this separate creator that sort of sits outside the universe, if you like. So the cosmos is no longer kind of divine and alive in itself, but it's the product of a separate creator. And the theme that kind of came through the whole book as I was sort of following these changing beliefs about the sky was really a separation, if you like, where we're separating ourselves from the universe that we live in. So we talked about in the Paleolithic, as best we can guess, that people didn't really have a separation between themselves and the world, between the world and the sky, between man and nature. And then you've got that kind of separation from nature, this idea of humans being able to create the sort of their own portals to the cosmos. Then you've got the idea of using sort of maths to explain and predict what's happening in the sky rather than needing to observe it directly. And now, rather than worshipping the sky itself, we've got a separate creator. And that's a kind of trajectory, if you like, that then continues through the book, through the history of beliefs about the sky.
So conflating a few of the later chapters together, you talk in numerous places about ideas of exploration and navigation, and latterly, you know, sort of, you know, right up to like space exploration. Basically, our horizons have widened from, you know, where you talk about Cook's voyages, Captain Cook's voyages, to later chapters talking about space exploration, and indeed, you know, the ideas of whether or not there might be other life out there in the universe. And I sort of wanted to talk about how this widening of our horizons through various different sort of levels of exploration has changed how we place ourselves in the cosmos.
Yeah, so I look in the book at the invention of clocks, for example, and kind of the development of the idea of abstract time. You know, initially people took their time from the sky, from the sun and from the moon. And once we had mechanical clocks, that completely changed. Again, we've separated time out. We've abstracted time from the cosmos around us. And now we see our clocks as more accurate than the sun. And then it's similar with space as well, that we've gone from using the sky for navigation to mathematicizing that, if you like. Now we've got this sort of abstract mathematical space, and we've got technology that can tell us exactly where and when we are. So again, our subjective experience of where we are is less important. And so as we're using more and more instruments and technology to kind of measure and explore the world around us, again, that first person subjective experience becomes less important. And in one of the chapters, I'm talking about Captain Cook and his first visit to Tahiti and how he meets the Polynesian sailors there. And it's kind of that clash of cultures where he's using his instruments to measure the transit of Venus because astronomers want to have a better idea about the size of the solar system so that they can then navigate better. He's using his instruments and charts to navigate. And the Polynesian sailors don't have any of that. It's all around their direct experience, looking at using star compasses, for example, but also using wind direction, looking at the currents in the ocean, looking for different wildlife. So, and they're sort of navigators' knowledge all then being bound up with religious beliefs and stories as well. So it's this clash between maximizing our sort of human subjective potential, if you like, or kind of outsourcing that to instruments and charts. And yeah, again, that's carried on since. You know, now astronomers, they don't actually look through telescopes anymore. You know, we study the light that comes from the sky, but it's all digitized. It's different frequencies of light are striking electronic detectors, and the data is being crunched by computers, and that's allowing us to see far further than our naked senses ever could. So it's giving us this unprecedented opportunity to explore further into the universe, which I think is an amazing thing. We understand so much more than we ever could have done. We can sort of travel so much further, but it's a different kind of journey, if you like. It's not we've kind of sacrificed our own personal experience, if you like. It's not about what we see and feel and think anymore. It's about this mathematical understanding of the sort of physical universe that's out there.
I've been talking to Jo Marchant. We've been talking about her latest book, The Human Cosmos, A Secret History of the Stars, which is out now in the UK from Canongate. Joe, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with us.
Great, thank you very much.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.